Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The last couple of decades have been really difficult for local newspapers. Between 2004 and 2019, a total of 2,100 papers across the country shut down. For the papers that have endured, media consolidation has been a very big part of the story. And often with consolidation come cost-cutting measures like mass layoffs of local journalists. And just recently, New York hedge fund Alden Global Capital made an offer to acquire one of the last big independent newspaper chains in the country, Lee Enterprises, which owns 75 daily newspapers, including 10 in Iowa, among them the Quad City Times, Sioux City Journal, and the Waterloo-Cedar Falls Courier. Lee Enterprises, based in Davenport, is trying to fight off this takeover. Later in the hour, I'll talk with two Iowans who are doing their best to keep local print journalism alive. Tony Baranowski is director of local media for Times Citizen Communications in Iowa Falls, and Kyle Munson is board president of the Western Iowa Journalism Foundation. But first, to help us understand what's going on with Alden Global Capital and Lee Enterprises, Benjamin Mullen is here, media reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Hello, Benjamin.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. Thank you so much for being here. And first, because we're talking to a lot of people right now who don't follow media and newspapers super closely, let's talk about these two different entities that are involved in this story. First, Lee Enterprises. It's based in Davenport, Iowa, publishes 77 daily newspapers in 26 states. So this is a pretty big organization.
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting. Like, if you look at the media generally, like, you know, Netflix, Warner Media Discovery, those are the big companies, right? So we tend to think of Lee, you know, as a relative minnow compared to sort of like the titans of the media industry. But Lee is definitely a newspaper publisher of considerable size, and it's one of the newspaper publishers of considerable size that is not currently owned by Alden Capital. There's only a few other newspaper chains like that in the U.S.
All right. And Alden Global Capital is a hedge fund. I want to start with that. What is a hedge fund exactly?
A hedge fund is a financial firm that uses money from partners to place bets on the market, basically.
All right. And why do they want newspapers?
Well, newspapers historically have been a very high profit margin business. I mean, we've seen, you know, over the last two decades, a lot of doom and gloom around the newspaper publishing industry, you know, because Google has like taken away the classifieds business and other tech firms have cut into ad revenue. But the truth of it is that for a very long time, even into the financial crisis, and even still today, many newspaper chains still make a pretty healthy profit margin. So, if you're a hedge fund who's interested in acquiring profitable businesses, one thing that you can do, which Alden Global has done, is buy up newspaper chains, take out some costs by, you know, selling off, extracting financial value by selling off real estate and taking out costs by, you know, cutting positions and merging titles, which is something that Alden Global has done at a lot of its places.
Right. And of course, a lot of people use the term gutting local newspapers. That has a strong sound to it. But it's also pretty accurate as far as their interest is in making money, not in the journalistic project or product so much.
That's certainly the contention that many, many journalists at newspapers that have been acquired by Alden Global have made. They say, you know, every time you guys come in, you guys fire a ton of people. And many of the journalists have said, basically, you're really affecting the ambitions and the quality of the journalism of the newspapers that you acquire.
Now, why can't Lee Enterprises just say, no, thank you, we don't want to be bought?
That's a great question. Lee Enterprises, like every publicly traded company in the U.S., has what's called a fiduciary obligation, which means they have to do what's best for shareholders. They're obligated to, really, by the law. And Alvin Global has offered to acquire the company at a premium to its previous closing share price before the deal was announced. So basically what's going on here is Alden has put Lee Enterprises and its shareholders to a decision, which is basically, you know, we're offering you all this money. You are legally obligated to give your shareholders the most value. How about a deal? And that's not an easy thing for a publicly traded company to say no to.
All right. But Lee Enterprises is trying to say no and trying to fight back here. And they've come up with what is called a poison pill solution. Help me understand what that means.
Yeah, absolutely. So my understanding of what's going on is that Lee Enterprises is essentially buying itself some time. So they haven't said really, at least I don't think they've said publicly, whether or not they are in favor of this acquisition proposal by Alden. But what they did do was they said, listen, we're looking at it. Also, we're adopting the shareholder rights plan, you know, which is also known as a poison pill, which effectively what it does is it prevents any activist shareholder from acquiring more than 10% of the company. So basically, if they try to acquire more than 10% of the company, there would be a dilutive event, which in plain English, basically, they would allow other shareholders to acquire an additional X percentage of the company that would essentially dilute Alden's position and make it impossible for them to acquire a controlling stake in the company. So this is basically designed to give them time to sort of figure out, consult with their financial advisors and decide what to do.
Will something like this work? Is there precedent for that?
Yeah, the courts have said this is A-okay. You can basically, it doesn't even have to be a pre-existing thing in your, you know, in your company bylaws. You can just decide to do this. So yeah, you can totally do this. But the thing is that the poison pill is only active for a year. So at a certain point, they're going to have to decide what to do. And some reporting that I have suggests that they won't actually take a year. They probably will, you know, take some measure that time. One person suggested to me maybe, you know, a few months, and then figure out exactly how they're going to respond to this offer.
Now, Alden Global Capital is so enormous and seems to want to acquire more and more of these newspaper companies. Are there any monopoly laws that might prevent them from continuing on this path?
That's a really good question. So my understanding, and again, I'm no antitrust expert, but my understanding is that generally speaking, if you acquire newspapers in markets where you don't already have a large footprint and you're not eliminating competitive newspapers, essentially, then you can continue to buy up titles in a specific region so long as you don't already have holdings there. The antitrust cases that I have sort of covered or been aware of have been in cases where a newspaper company has like tried to acquire two newspapers in the same region. And that's when the DOJ is like, that's like not good for readers because you control a bigger part of the market there.
Now, back in 2019, Alden Global Capital tried to take over Gannett, which, of course, is another huge publishing company and owns a lot of newspapers that a lot of our listeners read. Gannett fought back on that. So does that set a precedent?
Yeah, that's a really good example. I think so. I mean, one thing that Lee Enterprises might decide to do is do what Gannett effectively did, which is basically make their case to shareholders that the current management team is actually doing a really good job and they should remain in charge, and that in the very long run, you know, they have a better chance to create value for shareholders. One way this sometimes manifests is in what's called a proxy battle, where an activist investor like an Alden Global will say, hey, shareholders, we want you to vote to put our slate of corporate directors in, you know, the people at the top of the company on the board who can make decisions about whether to sell or merge the company. And they'll tell shareholders, hey, this is what we think you should do. These directors will do it. If you just vote for them, they'll make you a ton of money. And then, you know, on the other side, Lee Enterprises will say to shareholders, hey, our current slate of directors is doing a great job. Keep them in power and they will continue delivering for you. And it'll be down to corporate governance and voting.
And we saw that Gannett fighting off the takeover resulted, or at least led to, a pretty big merger later. So there are implications that go on after this battle for Lee Enterprises, no matter how it comes out, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if Lee Enterprises tells shareholders, hey, we can do a better job than Alden can, they're going to have to tell them exactly how. They're going to have to spell it out. And then the investors are going to expect results. And that could mean further, you know, transformational deals later on down the line, for sure.
All right. It's all really complicated. And I'm sure for people who read these newspapers, they're thinking, I don't know why I should be thinking about all of these things. What is the upshot of this? Why should somebody who's reading the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier or the Quad City Times, why should they care?
Well, that's a great question. I think it depends on what kind of newspaper you want to read. You know, privately owned newspapers and nonprofit news organizations, many of them, especially in local markets, end up having more journalists working for them, you know, per capita than some of the newspapers that are owned by Alden Global. And Alden Global has a history of reducing headcount at the titles that it acquires. So if you're a local reader and you like having a newsroom with that's fully staffed,
then you should care. We are out of time, Benjamin.
Maybe you should care.
Yeah. Thank you so much for talking with me, Benjamin Mullen, media reporter for the Wall Street Journal. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we're talking about local newspapers and the struggle to keep them going, the value of local journalism and efforts in Iowa to keep it alive. In a few minutes, I'll talk with Kyle Munson, formerly the Iowa columnist for the Des Moines Register. He is board president of the Western Iowa Journalism Foundation. And with me now is Tony Baranowski. He is director of local media for Times Citizens Communications in Iowa Falls. He was also the 2021 fellow of West Virginia University Reed College of Media and the West Virginia Press Association's New Start program. That is relevant because as part of his fellowship, he studied other locally owned newsrooms and published a paper on it. Hello, Tony.
Hi, Charity. Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And let's just recap, because those of us who work in local news pay a lot of attention to local news, and consumers of local news may not be thinking about all of the incredible challenges to local news all the time. I know this is something that looms large in our lives, but let's just kind of recap and look over the last 15 to 20 years at some of the just huge changes in culture that have caused incredible challenges for local news. What are some of the big ones?
Well, I mean, obviously, even when I was starting out, when I was at UNI 20 plus years ago, you know, people thought I was bonkers when I said I was going to go into the news business, or specifically the print news business. But I love it and I appreciate it. And I, what I have found over the years is these challenges that came up, be it, you know, corporations gobbling up properties or technology, which is the big one that I think for the general population, everybody thought, well, now that we have the internet, we don't need newspapers anymore, right? And what I've found is, you know, while it might have been reasonable at the time, it just turns out to not be the case, because you still need reliably sourced good journalism in communities from, you know, the lowest levels all the way up. And when I think about, you know, a lot of people consider it like a farm system, like we're the little guy, right? Well, that's true, but we also have some really great journalists working for community newspapers at our level across Iowa and across the country that make our product continually viable, not just to readers, but to advertisers.
Well, and of course, with technology, one of the big shifts that we all saw and we all participated in was that all of a sudden, all of this content was easy to access and a lot of it was free online. And newspapers, a lot of them just went with that because they needed eyeballs on the work that they were doing and created all of this free content, but then nobody was paying for it.
Exactly. And I'm really fortunate that I fell into a great situation in Iowa Falls where leadership saw that happening immediately in 2002, and Time Citizen has been behind a paywall. So we've retained our readership without having to, you know, slide that in 5 years ago, 8 years ago, when a lot of other media companies were coming to the realization that, hey, we still need to charge readers.
Right.
That part of the equation was never going to go away. There are others that are finding ways to do more production of a free product, specifically some nonprofits. You have some great startups that are coming up all over the country. I went to there were a couple that were part of my New Start program. Becky Palak in Tucson, Arizona has a really cool project that she's launching. And it doesn't all need to be advertising driven. It doesn't all need to be reader or consumer driven. But for we legacy publications, it's still part of the deal.
Tell us a little bit about your organization for people who don't live in the Iowa Falls area. Tell us about the work that you do.
Sure. Time Citizen is a little bit different than you would think for a small media company in a rural community in Iowa. We have the Time Citizen, kind of our flagship. And when I came here, you know, the idea was not that the Time Citizen was going to be incredibly profitable, because we had other dimensions to the company and still have other dimensions to the company. We work with ag publications across the country, including the Iowa Farm Bureau. We sell advertising into those publications. We print some of those publications at our facility here. We also have a radio station in-house. We do press release distribution nationwide, work with a lot of small colleges across the country. So we have some different dimensions, and we employ about, you know, 60 to 70 people at any given time. Different than a lot of small mom-and-pop shops, but still our dedication to the local news product is, you know, one of the primary goals here.
When you were looking around at other local news organizations that have survived, is that one of the things that you found, is that places that have diversified and come up with ways to make money and maybe are using some of those profits to invest in local news, even though that may not be making them money? Is that something, a pattern that you found in a lot of places?
Yeah, there's no question. You're probably talking about some of the stuff that I cited in my report for New Start. I mean, diversification of revenue is part of the plan moving forward for any media company that wants to be successful and productive. So there, it's everything from selling merchandise, you know, T-shirts and candles and ball caps, you name it, to there's a, I think I cited a newspaper in Kansas or maybe Nebraska that has a liquor store in the back. There are all kinds of different ways that you can supplement what you're doing to continue to be dedicated to that local news product, and that's what local news people are finding different ways to do. There are other media, you know, methods of doing that. For instance, here we have a radio station. A lot of companies are delving into different digital sales methods and you know, being a little bit more full service in terms of their marketing needs, running social media accounts, those kinds of things. Those are things that we know how to do and are good at and can, you know, kind of link to what we're already doing for the companies that we partner with.
At the core of that, though, there has to be this sort of mission-driven work. You have to believe that local journalism has value to your community to invest all of that time, energy, and creativity in coming up with a way to make it possible.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's the big difference when you were talking to Ben about what Alden Global Capital is doing. You know, there's a reason that they invest in newspapers. It's because newspapers can make them money. The idea that newspapers have been dying is, it was very simplistic. Newspapers have been hurting because they've been assaulted by these investors. So at the local level, what you find is a ton of, you know, people who are dedicated to their community and the communities that they serve all the way across the country. I mean, it was not hard for me to find good examples in every state that I looked into. It was more difficult to boil down, you know, exactly which ones I wanted to use. Because there are a lot of people across this country that are still dedicated to community journalism. And when I say that, community journalism is different than what you may connect to a Des Moines Register or Waterloo Courier or one of the big dailies, because our business model is different. They need to generate clicks. They need to generate interest and keep people engrossed. We need to serve our community and keep our community moving forward. We need to advocate for what's best for the people of Iowa Falls and Hardin County and expect that by doing that, it's going to come back to us in the end.
Well, and these other larger publications are also covering a larger area, larger population. There's more happening. I think that would be easy to argue. So when you're
right, and because they've been cut back, they have fewer journalists to do what they've always done. Now, that is not to say that they're not still doing great work. The Cedar Rapids Gazette does fantastic work. The Des Moines Register does great work. The Waterloo Courier does great work. They have great journalists that are dedicated to their readership, but their resources have been hamstrung.
Yeah.
And that's got nothing to do with, you know, the people who are feet on the ground.
In a smaller community where there might be a daily newspaper, but more likely a weekly newspaper that really covers community stories, things that would not be considered news by some of these larger publications. Tell me about the value of that. Why is that so important to have?
You know, it makes me smile to think about it. It's it's the kind of thing that we really do love to do. And we still, we're not immune to the comparisons to mainstream media or, you know, being the purveyors of, you know, negative headlines. A lot of our COVID coverage drew criticism because people were like, oh, we're just tired of it. And guess what? We were tired of
right.
it, too.
We're all tired of it.
Remain tired of it.
Yeah.
Right. But it was still important to the community. And those positive stories, those personality features, which I am really proud to say, man, we have a great staff that comes up with great ideas and digs into things. We just had a really good story over the weekend about an 89-year-old guy who showed up at the local brewery, made friends with the owners at Timbuck Brew here in Iowa Falls, and not too long after that, he basically started a career as a singer for them. He shows up, you know, a couple different times a month and performs and draws a crowd. Those kind of stories are not going to be told anywhere else, and it really does give people a connection to the place where they are, the place where they call home.
You mentioned some of the more recent upstarts. So we have seen a lot of local papers go out of business, and not every community that needs to be covered is going to have a paper that, you know, goes back 100 years or some of those things. We've lost some of those long legacies in a lot of these communities. But you are seeing hyper-local upstarts, whether they have a physical paper, but usually they don't, maybe an online presence. Tell me what you're seeing there, because I've seen a lot come and go. I've seen a lot fail. There have been, you know, some that have stuck around and done some really incredible work. But how is that part of local journalism evolving in your view?
Well, I think, you know, there are a lot of contributing factors to that, and you're right. We've lost a lot of legacy publications, but I'm not sure that we have lost as many journalists as people sometimes think we have. If you look at the number of people who are actually employed by legacy publications, yeah, that is way down. But you think about, you know, all of the cast-offs, these people who used to work for, and you're going to be talking to Kyle Munson here in just a little bit, used to work for legacy publications that are now doing great work in other ways. We also have, you know, Iowa Starting Line that's employing some good people. We have I think about Amy Duncan in Indianola, who used to run the Indianola newspaper for Gannett, and when that position went away, she continued on with her mission and started an online publication where she's doing the kind of storytelling that we were just talking about, the things that make people feel good about the place that they live.
When you and I got into journalism, Tony, you know, there was sort of this ladder. I know that I started climbing it and jumped off the ladder and decided I wanted to come back to Iowa and do journalism here. You live in Iowa Falls. You do local journalism. And there has been this pressure to go to larger and larger publications, larger and larger markets for journalists to feel like they are succeeding. Do you feel like that is changing?
I hope so. And that's the kind of part of my message moving forward is, you know, journalists need to know that their impact, while the footprint might not be as big as working at a major metro, their impact can be even more profound working for a community organization like ours. You're right. I, you know, and I was not immune to that. I wanted to go to Chicago. My dad is originally from Chicago, and that's where I expected to end up and tried to get to early in my career. But I take zero credit for this. I lucked into Iowa Falls. I came here because my wife, Sarah, who is the editor and my co-publisher here, I know you introduced me as director of local media, but that just changed in the last couple of weeks. Mm. So we're co-publishers at Time Citizen now. She got a job at the Fort Dodge Messenger. I had to find a job in this part of the state. I came to Iowa Falls to be a sports editor. Was very fortunate in the years that followed. The leadership here kind of brought me along, gave me leadership training. They saw things in me that I never saw in myself. I thought I was going to be a career, reporter. And they invested in me to kind of open my own eyes as to the possibilities here in Iowa Falls. And those are the kinds of things that we need more community journalists to be willing to do, because the next generation, there are a lot of aging publishers across this country, and we need to be able to fill those holes with people who are just as invested.
And we also need to pay them a living wage, but maybe we'll talk about that another day. Tony Baranowski, thank you
Absolutely.
So much. All right. Tony Baranowski, co-publisher with the Times Citizen Communications in Iowa Falls. We will continue talking about local newspapers, local journalism in Iowa in just a moment with Kyle Munson. This is Talk of Iowa.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we are talking about local newspapers, what makes their work important, and efforts to keep them alive. One of those efforts is the relatively newly formed Western Iowa Journalism Foundation. It's a nonprofit dedicated to ensuring access to accurate local news and investigative reporting in Iowa, west of I-35. Kyle Munson, who was for many years the Iowa columnist for the Des Moines Register, is the board president for the Western Iowa Journalism Foundation. He is on the line with me now. Hello, Kyle.
Hello, Charity. Hey, thanks so much for having this conversation.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me. And now, I know a lot of people have seen the documentary Storm Lake. And in that documentary, we got to see at least the sideline of some of the early conversations about the Western Iowa Journalism Foundation. Give us the origin story. How did this come about?
Yeah, exactly. It really did begin as a conversation among publishers, like Tony, whom you're just talking to, in Western Iowa, like Art Cullen and Doug Burns and Carroll and others, about, to the point of the diversification you're talking about, what is a stable future for these local newsrooms if you're going to remain independent and remain dedicated, to the community foremost? And that started this whole notion of, is there a new model for a nonprofit? Not just there are, as you've discussed during this hour, there are some nonprofit models and newsrooms that are springing up around the country. What if you took that on a regional approach, and how would that look? And could that be a model to help preserve even, these mom and pop for-profit newsrooms? And what would that look like? So that began what has become the Western Iowa Journalism Foundation today.
Well, and those early conversations also were about cooperation, because there are a number of these small papers in Western Iowa working extremely hard to cover their communities, but also to fill the paper with fresh content every day. So there was and is sharing going on that's part of this process, right?
Yeah, there have been creative partnerships and trying to diversify revenue streams and supporting each other in a very collegial way. But this is such a deep infrastructural problem, and it's true. Tony's newsroom has great diversification, as he outlined with the radio and the printing jobs and those sorts of things. So, you know, how do you, for not every newsroom has that. So what do we do on a larger scale to say, okay, can philanthropy be a bridge to the future as, you know, newsrooms like the Stormlight Times grow their digital subscriptions? You know, it's just a different model. You know, as you've been talking about, you know, some of the corporate structures, and, you know, will Alden take over more newspapers, et cetera. You know, when you need growth on that scale, that's where you that leads to selling off real estate, and you have fewer journalists employed in these communities. So it's different when you're a locally owned publication like the Stormlight Times, where you end up, you know, if you're going to dedicate yourself to that newsroom and say, hey, my family works here, you know, we're going to stay here for our readers, then you end up with key people in the newsroom who go on Social Security early, like Art and his brother John, right, and end up working for free. You know, that doesn't work in the larger you know, the kind of models where you need that growth to string these newsrooms together and to generate a profit. But maybe we can diversify through this nonprofit to help these newsrooms find a successful bridge and stay independent for decades to come.
Yeah, our Colin has been very open about the financial challenges at the Stormlight Times, and you just referenced the fact that he and his brother say they've retired and went on Social Security while they're still donating their time to the newspaper to keep it afloat. That's not the kind of thing that is very sustainable for a family, for individuals, and for an organization either. I, of course, work for a nonprofit news organization, Kyle, you know that, and we're pretty open about how that works here at Iowa Public Radio. Help me understand how this nonprofit consortium works to support these local publications.
Yeah, well, you know, we have, you know, number one, we have a great executive director and board. You know, Becky Bonamy is a trained journalist and just really experienced in grant writing and in grants in general. And then I've got a lot of talent on this board alongside me, journalism professor, community college provost, business owner, et cetera, et cetera. And we came together last year, but then we're officially had official IRS approval just early this year. And so we don't even really have a full year's work under our belt yet, but already we've made a lot of progress. And, you know, our mission is to inform and educate the residents of Western Iowa by, you know, preserving, sustaining this access to quality local news and community journalism. And we do that by, this independent is an important part of the mission, this independent news. And what we do is we're able to deploy both kind of quick assist grants to, you know, help newsrooms keep the lights on, but then also larger sums to enable that transformation. So, you know, this isn't about preserving print newspapers, obviously, in every case. I mean, that we're not saying that we will have a printing press in every community. But what is the way to sustain that news and information that is so crucial to have these publishers and editors on the front lines in these, you know, smaller communities where they can combat misinformation and disinformation, you know, where you don't just have a Facebook group that is where people are getting information from the city council meetings or, you know, dealing with just other matters in the community. So it's kind of that two-pronged approach about, you know, quick assist, transformational assistance. And then, you know, we get into things like just even succession planning for finding new generations of publishers and editors in these communities, like Tony was talking about. You know, elevating some of the underrepresented and diverse voices. You know, we've been working with La Prensa, which is a Hispanic publication in Western Iowa, and has been very, Lorena Lopez has been very important to that community with, you know, combating some of the misinformation in the midst of this pandemic and just getting access to vaccines and that sort of a thing. So there's a lot of work to do, and that's just kind of, those are the broad strokes.
You mentioned, and part of your mission is to make sure that accurate news is available to people in Western Iowa. And bringing up the kind of misinformation that so many people have been fed through social media and through some national news organizations as well, do you feel like local newspapers like La Prensa, like the Storm Lake Times, like the paper in Carroll, do you feel like these local sources can combat that kind of huge machinery of misinformation?
I mean, I guess yes. I realize it seems like a David Goliath situation, but if not them, who then who? That's where I think this again. It's not about the print model that existed before, but it's finding the model for this kind of news that will exist for decades to come. You do need to have people who are professionally dedicated to, quality news and information on behalf of the community, and that's their full-time duty in some respect. I do think that makes a difference because when you can look the editor in the eye, that's just a whole different relationship to, how you relate to a national news brand, on your social feeds and the different kinds of conversations or arguments you have. I do think that's one of our only hopes to kind of moderate all this polarization that we're constantly complaining about today.
You're focusing your work on Western Iowa, which is pretty big. there's a whole yeah. lot of land west of I-35. But you've started really with a focus in four counties. What is the vision for the future?
Well, the vision, the vision is to build and scale up, just systematically. We can't bite off more than we can chew. I mean, we can't be a PPP program for local news or anything like that. That's why we're trying to take deliberate steps. And a phased approach, this first pilot phase in these four counties, and then just expand from there. I mean, we're still getting up to full operability, and we need to have operating funds to have a full annual budget and to be able to really work at full speed. So that's our current goal. And, of course, this fall with the Storm Lake Times film has been a huge asset in that. We had the national broadcast on PBS, and there have been screenings, and it's been on the film circuit. I attended some wonderful screenings here in Iowa, up in Okoboji, and another one in Algona, and just to see the audiences respond to this, it was just, and the conversations that happened afterward, it was just rewarding. It was special. And so that gives me a sense that what we're talking about here is really resonating. And we just need to just do it in a deliberate, very systematic way.
One of the other things that you've talked about in your mission is making sure to facilitate investigative journalism. And of course, a lot of small newspapers around the country just don't have the staff or the resources to really do investigative journalism. Tell me a little bit about your view and your hopes for what you may be able to allow local journalists to do with this.
Yeah, I mean, you were talking a little bit before about the community journalism being somewhat different from what somebody might think of a large metro newsroom. And it's true that you have those personal features and all sorts of things that are part of that community journalism that really sustains it, that range, right? That storytelling that gives the community a sense of itself. Well, I think we do have a legacy here in Iowa, maybe especially, of still having some quality investigative journalism that is part of the smallest news organizations. And so, and having that mix is really crucial. I mean, you can be a good watchdog for your city council as well as, talking about somebody's 70th anniversary or the story of the singer-songwriter in the brew pub that Tony was mentioning. I mean, that's all part of it. But for the investigative especially, an organization like us where we can have alliances with national partners and do different things to say maybe, help bring some special knowledge into a local newsroom to aid that investigative reporting or to, help help them cover a particular topic that gets into some investigations. That's where we can be an asset and connect some dots and bring in some funding that would tackle that specifically, where if it's tough for them just to cover some of the community stories, let alone get into some more investigative territory, we can do that in a meaningful way, you know, probably for multiple newsrooms. And so we're looking at that too.
There's an organization based mostly on the eastern side of the state, Iowa Watch, which is another nonprofit, the Center for Public Affairs Journalism. And that's one of their focuses, is to make investigative journalism possible. And it also gives young journalists an opportunity to really do some bigger stories and to really explore some topics that often journalists at that point in their career don't get an opportunity to do. Is that also a hope for you? You talked about cultivating the next generation of publishers. What about the next generation of journalists?
Yeah. No, I mean, that's important. I mean, and Iowa Watch, a great organization. There's another one that has sprung up recently in Nebraska, the Flatwater Free Press. You know, there's some people involved with that I know. And there are a lot of great nonprofits that I would encourage, you know, people, if it's in their wheelhouse, if it's part of their local story, that they can also support. You know, we are a little bit different from some of them in that, you know, we are aimed squarely at the infrastructural problem in that sense. So, you know, we're not as a nonprofit, we're not in the content game quite as much, mm-hmm. Just in terms of, you know, we are going to produce content that can help, you know, be deployed to these different newsrooms. You know, we're kind of trying to tackle the infrastructural problem and the funding problem to, you know, to help build again, rebuild from the ground up. I'm in favor of every model that's going to help us find this future path for journalism. So we are a little bit different in that way, in terms of, you know, unlike, I don't know, Report for America or some other organizations, we're not out there to kind of push this new generation of journalists out there, but we're going to try to make sure we build the homes for them where they can do good work.
We recently saw WBEZ, the public radio station in Chicago, buy the Chicago Sun-Times and, you know, bring that under their umbrella as a nonprofit news organization as well. Do you think that nonprofit is the future of news, of quality local journalism in this country?
I mean, I don't know if it's the answer, but I mean, it's definitely, I mean, it's a part of what we're doing. It's part of the answer. I mean, we exist because it's part of the answer, I would say. But, you know, whether or not you're a nonprofit newsroom or a for-profit newsroom, I mean, you have to have a clear mission, transparency, a real connection to your audience, and you have to build credibility and keep it. I mean, that's true no matter if you're funded by advertising or, you know, other streams. You know, maintaining that credibility is how you operate as a newsroom, regardless of your funding. So that holds true. But, you know, nobody has cracked the code quite yet. That's why you see all these experiments happening, and we're trying to, you know, just coordinate with allies and partners around the country to see if we can have a proof of concept here in one of the toughest areas to do that, you know, rural middle America, growing news deserts, you know, smaller communities. And I think we can do a lot of good for communities everywhere.
You've seen a lot in your career in journalism, and you left journalism, although you obviously didn't leave journalism behind. Are you feeling hopeful in this moment?
Yeah, I mean, I also want to qualify that I have such deep respect and love for journalists in every kind. I mean, I had a wonderful, rewarding career in quote unquote corporate news for 24 years, right? So I there is good journalism that can happen in every newsroom, and I know dedicated journalists in all kinds of newsrooms. So I guess I am hopeful, and you know, just like even in my career through watching social media rise. You know, creatively, there was a lot of fulfilling work that was enabled by all these new tools.
Yeah. Kyle, unfortunately, we are out of time. Kyle Munson of the Western Iowa Journalism Foundation. You can find out more on their website. This is Talk of Iowa.